So yeah, my name, Dennis Rosset. You probably have those details on the GitHub account. They should be like the things for March 9 on the course GitHub. So I trust that you can pull like the latest version, get the files on your computer. What I advise, because we have a few minutes, the server can be overloaded when we compile Julia packages. So the thing is, we are going to use Julia, but I'll tell you a few things about like other programming languages. The thing is, if everybody downloads the things and compiles stuff at the same time and downloads, it's going to be super slow. So while we have those few minutes now, you can basically do that in the background, like log on SSH, git pull, get the Python notebooks, see if you can open them. I'm not going to use the computer for the first half of the lecture, but what you can do is, they are numbered, like exercise zero is basically package.add of all the things that we are going to use, just run those cells, and if any error happens, then you can mention that to me or Eric, and we can take, like, if there are really major problems, we'll take a break and we'll look at that. We've checked, like, it worked on Eric's account, it worked on mine, even if my account was weird because it's an old one. So yeah, don't expect major problems. Actually, I'll put that on the board. I think I've never, it's all fancy. So. That I don't need to repeat that when people join a bit later. So the thing is, like Eric sent everybody like an email. Which topic would you like to see during the computational physics lecture? Actually, it was a clever ploy to outsource the lecture to other people. So I said, why not convex optimization and so on? And then I realized my name was on the schedule, and Eric sent me an email like, hey, do you want to do that? I was like, yes. The thing is, I'm not a postdoc, so which means I'm super specialized in quantum information and even like quantum foundation, working with Rob Steckens. How many of you are actively doing things in quantum information? Like, I don't expect many hands. And that's one thing we need to address, because if I teach you how to compute non-locality measures, how much of that are you going to use for your own stuff? So I'll tell you how I will solve that problem during the lecture. But first, before I tell you what I planned, what I'd like to know is what you've used in terms of optimization, constraint satisfaction, feasibility things. I think we all have. And then I will ask you about like, what do you expect to do during like the next month, the next year of research? Are you going to use that? If no, then okay, like you're doing maybe that for credit. But I can tailor like at least the second module on Wednesday to your interest, if that's possible. So let's say like what you've done in the past, and the title is convex optimization, but I'll remove the convex, I'll put it in parentheses. Because there is overlap between non-convex and convex. We'll see that a bit later. Has anybody done some convex optimization of feasibility, solving feasibility problems, doing constraint satisfaction? Does that ring a bell or not at all? Yeah, what problem space were you working on?
Non linear Einstein's equations.
You linearized?
Non linear Einstein's equations. Like,
yeah.
And you try to find the solution for a couple non linear equations using.
So were you solving a nonlinear system of equation? Were you maximizing some function of variables?
I was solving using a nonlinear solver, essentially, like trying to get a minimum constraints.
So that's important. It's going to pop up in the lecture. There are basically two things you can do. I will abstract over the problem, put real variables, could be complex, and we split it into real and imaginary. One form of things you could do is you have a function that goes from Rn to Rm, and you're trying to see, does that exist an x such that this is satisfied? Was it your problem? OK. Anybody else has done stuff? I'm sure we all have. Like, the first time I did optimization was using Excel in a physics lecture, and I'll tell you what it was. OK. I think everybody has done nonlinear fit. Right, when we had our linear fit, when we got some experimental data, and then we have a model, maybe some exponential, and then we try to fit exponential on the data. Like the first time I've done that, I think it was even in high school, maybe, we used the solver in Excel. So Excel, like you can write your sum of squares minimization in Excel, and there is like an add-on called the solver. It's pretty crappy, but it actually works for high school things. So that's when I started to do optimization. Who has done actually like those kind of nonlinear fits during? Okay, like actually, has everybody a physics background, or people coming from like computer science or mathematics?
Should be all physics.
Should be all physics. So nonlinear fits, feasibility problems. Has anybody used, for example, a SAT solver? Okay, cool. Can you tell us what's a SAT solver actually? What you use it for?
I mean, I use it to play around, but if you have a 3-SAT formula and you want a satisfying assignment of the variables. You can actually reduce lots of problems to SAT problems and then solve SAT problems, figure out bugs in your code or check circuits.
Okay. There is a thing that I like in what you said, is that reduce to some normal form, and that's something that's going to pop up later. I'll go back to that in a minute. I'm going to mention like a few things that I've done, and you'll see if that rings a bell for you. So basically, for the people who just joined, pull the stuff on GitHub. I created a folder for today's lecture. There is a somebody's coming, then I'll restart the rewind. So pull the latest stuff on GitHub. There is a Jupyter notebook called Exercise Zero Installation. You run the cells, it's going to download all the packages. And I'd like that you do that. If it's not like, if you have a problem, raise your hand, we'll pause. But do that, run it, so that we don't have to wait 5 minutes when we switch to the computer and everybody is compiling stuff on the cluster. So yeah, run the cells. It's like package.add with like all the packages that are going to come in the lecture. What I've done was like asking people what kind of optimization problem did they already solve. Somebody was doing nonlinear root finding. We more or less have all done nonlinear fitting, doing like labs, like undergrad lab, like you get some data, you do a least square fit, you try to estimate the error, and so on. One person used a SAT solver, which is basically, you could solve Sudoku with it, like all kind of combinatorial problems. The things that I've done in undergrad, I've used MATLAB, and I think Maple. And in MATLAB, there is this familiar function. They are called fmincon or fminunc. And they basically do a nonlinear optimization. So that's kind of the things that we will have done. Now the question I have, like, are you going to use any of this in your research, like optimization? Do you foresee any use of the topic? And if so, like what would be exactly the domain? Maybe not, and then we just do that for fun.
I wanted to learn how to use Konica's DPs because there is a
the winter school project that we were working on
okay.
seemed to be so easier with that, and I don't understand them very well. So
okay.
And I think it's related.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I asked like people before, like that was at the very beginning, who is doing actively stuff in quantum information? Convex optimization will pop up all the time. Now I'm going to tell you, oh, I'm going to adapt the, somebody's going to do SDPs, which is a pretty technical part of convex optimization. May need to solve at some stage like polynomial optimization problems that can pop up. But it really depends on the problem space. If you do a lot of numerical simulations, maybe like getting a point is very expensive, so you don't want to optimize over stuff. I, during my PhD and afterwards, I tended to work with like problems that have medium size, so they work very well with like optimization methods. Anyway, what I want to do, the lecture, the title was Convex Optimization. My background is in quantum information. And what I like about quantum information is that we get a lot of examples that are pretty simple to grasp. So you won't need to learn anything that you haven't seen in a PSI lecture. I guess, at least PSI, you have seen what a qubit is, what a projective measurement is. Like, does everybody know what a projective measurement is and could compute like the probability of getting a measurement outcome? Is it something you're familiar with? Just checking. Actually, what kind of class did you have for like quantum info or quantum mechanics? Like, I mean, the non-relativistic, finite-dimensional stuff. What have you done?
We had it embedded in class that we also saw path integral, so we covered through quantum information quite quickly. But
okay.
The basics, I think, like we, yeah.
Okay. It's not going to be, what I'm going to do is not very fancy. So the outlook that I had going in that course, that I will use examples from quantum info, but I use them as kind of a pretext to talk about important things the day you need to use numerical techniques, and that could even go beyond optimization. Still, optimization is a big, so they are basically examples that are like toy problems. To see some features of those algorithms and how you use them. And I will, like for the second lecture, I will even show you all these methods fail, so that when they fail on you, you will recognize it and you at least know that something's wrong and you look for people to find a way out. So what I'm going to do now is basically to look at the problem space. What can we do with like optimization techniques? What solvers are out there? So that if you have a problem in mind, we don't have a lot like, of things that you're going to do, but the day you have a problem in mind, it's kind of a decision tree what you can use. So, that said, where did I have that stuff? Okay. Actually, I had something written somewhere. Okay, whatever. So, the first thing is that when we say optimization, we want to maximize or minimize the value, but not necessarily. So what I'm going to look at is basically a few features of optimization problems. And we will see how the problem space divides. So if you have n equals 0, what you have is a feasibility problem. So that's, you could actually phrase the nonlinear root finding problem that you had here with the linearized equations. You could phrase it as an optimization problem. You just say, I maximize 0, my objective is trivial, and I want to find a point that satisfies those constraints. And that's a legit thing to do. Most of the time, you just have one objective, and that's kind of run-of-the-mill run-of-the-mill optimization problem. And if you have multi-objective optimization, that starts to be a bit specialized. Here, what you're looking at is to find the trade-off between things. And this goes like into a specialized class of method that will recover like the kind of optimal front of things that's I can have more of X if I reduce a bit Y. So you want to see how that frontiers look like. It's called the Pareto frontier. And in the past, I've used genetic algorithm for that. They're pretty fun. They're good algorithm because they keep the diversity of your problem space and make it involved and try to fill that frontier. But I'm not going to talk about multi-objective optimization because it's very out there. The cool thing about feasibility problems is that they can be embedded in those things by just putting a trivial objective. So I will assume that we're just maximizing one value. So our problem looks like something minimize a function of real variables. Oh, wait a minute. Just because that's my next question. For the variables, you can have different things. The first thing is you could work only on binary variables. And this is where our integer variables, and if that's your case, then you're going to go to combinatorial optimization. Basically, what the software is going to do is to look at all the possibilities, but being clever, trying to cut down the branches in that enumeration that violate constraints. So here you're looking at either SAT solvers, and there is something called mini-SAT that we've used in the past pretty successfully, or satisfiability modulo theory, and Microsoft has an excellent toolbox called Z3. It works well. Like, what's amazing is when you can reduce your problem to some form that has been studied to death, those codes are highly optimized, and you can go through, like, I don't know, 2 to the power 128 possibilities, but because you have so many cuts, you get an answer in seconds. It's impressive. Good question. let me Google that. I've used them 2 years ago during a summer project. So it's the canonical SAT. Is it just satisfaction?
They're
just satisfiability. It's not an acronym. It's basically the prototype of an NP-hard problem. And SAT, it's basically a form where you have Boolean variables and all your constraints look like A or B and C is equal is true, and you have a list of those constraints, and the solver is trying to assign Boolean values to all the variables in your problem. We won't do that during the lecture. Because I think it's quite niche, like not a lot of physics maps to combinatorial optimization problems. Another type of variables that you could get, it's when your variables are exact, and as a subtype, I would put something like algebraic, which means basically comes from polynomials. So sometimes, especially when your problem size is small, you can just go to Mathematica and ask Mathematica to solve your maximization problem. The good thing is that if it's small enough, you will get an answer that's algebraic. And that works very well for polynomial, like small polynomial systems. I mean, by small, I mean 5 or 10 variables, not more. The complexity of those algorithms, it's doubly exponential, something like that. Go to something that's called cylindric algebraic decomposition in Mathematica and you're golden. That leaves us to the last thing, and that's what we will consider today. When your type is floating point. So I think all the examples that you've done during this computational physics class use like 60-bit floats. Like, did you have to type like float 64 in Julia? So that's basically the number type that's like the natural type for nowadays CPUs. This is what we are going to do. And yes, because computations are going to be fast, and that will enable to scale the problem. Still, when your variables are floating points, you're going to get problem like scaling. Like if you add very small and very large quantities in the same problem, you're going to have a catastrophic cancellation. If you have degeneracies, it could be that the solver handles that badly. And there are a few things that can fail with floating point solvers. That's going to be the topic of the next class. I'm going to prepare examples that fail, and we are going to see how we can get better. There is a mix of, let's say, continuous and integer variables. And people call that mixed integer programming. It's not going to be the topic of the course. If that pops up, you have efficient solvers for that. So basically, right now, floating point and one objective. The things I still need to tell you about is we have constraints and what's convexity. Because these are going to be the main features of that will enable us to pick a solver. So, objective type. So the things goes like this. If you're trying to find the minimum of that function, and that function will correspond to a convex set, this one will be non-convex. The thing is, you don't need to be especially smart to solve that kind of problem. You just look where you are, you look where the slope is going, and you just follow until you get to a minimum. And when you get to a minimum, basically, the derivative is the first derivative is zero. The second derivative has a right curvature for a minimum. Then you're golden. You have found your optimum, and it's global. The problem of non-convex objectives is that you may well converge to a local optimum that's not global. And this is why I will be focusing on convex optimization because that's the way to write papers and have results that are reproducible because it's not like luck that you find the right one or not. So that's basically the big divide. When you optimize over non-convex functions, what I will do is like run the problem many times and see what the statistic of the values. Try to find a different method to compute an upper bound so I can, or here that will lower bound to see how big is that gap. There are ways around that. The problem is anytime you use non-convex optimization, you don't have any guarantees about optimality. There will be a lot of heuristics to go around the problem space, but it's kind of more like a black magic or dark arts than real science. Convex optimization, it's great, it has guarantees. There are two things. We can have constraints as well. So basically, you take the problem that was there, and now x is a real variable because we focus on continuous problems. And we can have additional functions that tell us, for example, that g is equal to 0 for all i's and another family of functions that would define nonlinear inequalities. And now we are solving that problem here. And now convexity is also going to play a role there. I don't know if you play those video games where like the characters really, like the AI is really stupid. So I think it was Warcraft 2. Like, if there was like a forest that had that kind of non-convex shape, and you had one of your guys over there, and you said, okay, please go here. What would happen is that the character would go here, get stuck because this AI was made to run on like all computers, and there was no way there was an algorithm looking at global information. The only thing for that move was basically go as far as possible when there is a wall, follow the wall, and then when you're like basically stuck, you just stay there. I think things have progressed a lot since WCWF 2. But that's going to be a problem for optimization algorithm. If we are maximizing a function and our set is not convex, and let's say we start here, and we tell the algorithm to optimize and go as far as possible in that direction. If you only look at local information, what you're going to do is go in that direction until you encounter a wall, follow the wall until you can't progress anymore, and then you're going to say, okay, that's my optimal. But if you add global information, you would see that you have a way of getting to the other side, actually. If that's the direction, the normal would be like here. So it probably converges somewhere here if you have global information. So again, if you have non-convex constraints, you have no guarantees of converging to the global optimum. And moreover, if you have sufficiently nasty equality or inequality constraints, maybe you don't even find a point that's feasible. Maybe the algorithm can't find an X that would satisfy everything here. So non-convex optimization can be tricky. The last thing I want to mention before we move on to practical stuff. Okay, I was thinking that maybe here. So the last question about the problem is how do you define the objective and the constraints? And there are basically three ways you can do that. The first one is, okay, question. If I write stuff over there, can everybody see that part? So it's an algorithm that will see the objective f and the constraint function g and h as black boxes. So you basically, in Julia, you would have something like function f of x would be a vector, and you do your computation and you return something. And the same for the gi and the hj. The problem with that approach is that the solver will not be able to get any global information about your problem. Because the only thing that the solver will use is your function as oracles, call them with parameters at specific points, and try to converge to something. But this is like the most general form of an algorithm, like of a solver. That's a solver that would be as generic as possible, because you could put like anything you want in those methods. There is something that those solver will do. They will try to use gradient and sometime even like, so that's a first order derivative, or the Hessian, which is the second order derivative. And sometimes you have to provide yourself the gradient as part of the definition for your objective. At the very like opposite, you have solvers that have canonical forms. These tend to be the most efficient solvers because they expect something very structured from you, and they can use that information to compute things faster. What I will give you, and I just want to be consistent in the notation, is what happens for linear programs that we're going to see exactly what a linear program is later. I'm doing minimization of a real variable, minimizing the dot product of that variable with a data vector C. And what I'm asking, as well, like data matrices A and a data vector B, and I'm asking that all the components of X are non-negative. Something that we'll use the notation in the course is when I do the greater or equal for a vector, it means component by component. So basically, if you use a solver that works with a canonical form, what you're going to do is to provide the matrices, the matrix A and the vectors B and C, and that's it. And you run the solver. But you need to wiggle your problem around so that it corresponds to that form. And sometimes it's very painful to do. So often what people do, they use modeling frameworks. That basically take an algebraic description of your stuff. And we'll move it to the canonical form of some solver. So they are modeling framework for non-convex programs. But mostly, that's what we'll focus on. Those frameworks are super popular for convex programming. We'll see that later. I think that's all I wanted to say about the problem space. I'm going to take a small break there and see if you have questions. Check for like rhythm. Is it too fast? Or like, I mean, am I using too much jargon? It's the first time I'm teaching this, so like, I welcome like questions. If there are no questions, I will move on to like describe what's the landscape for Julia. Toolboxes. Then I'm going to tell you a little bit about quantum information, and we'll move straight on to examples, like the notebooks that we have for the lecture. So, I don't know. Has anybody used Julia in research, in their research? Apart from Eric? Just, I'll do a small poll. Who is actually actively or has actually done in research like numerical computing in the room? Which languages did you use, or which environment did you use for like numerics? Python? MATLAB? Python and MATLAB?
I use Fortran.
What?
Fortran 19.
Fortran, okay. Any other languages? These three?
R,
okay. And Root, somebody has done Root. Amazing. it's painful. So Fortran, nobody has done C++ or C++, yes. What was the quality of the packages that you, did you code directly in those programming languages? Or were you using stuff that was built upon the language? Like, I don't know, Root is C++ under the hood, but it's a complete environment of things you can use. Have you used like packages from other people?
Yeah, Fortran, they're very stable because they're very old and have been used.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's quite reliable. It's just an annoying language sometimes.
Okay. Like why am I speaking about this? It's because I'm going to teach the course using Julia, but I'm mainly a MATLAB guy. And MATLAB shares the same thing as Fortran. It's a very irritating language, full of like mismatches between things. But it's very stable. Like you have packages that date from decades, and they are very polished. My frustration often with academic software that people write the software just to get a paper out, and then you look at things and it does 90% of what you need, but to do the 10 remaining percent, like the author left academia already, and you don't know what to do with the code. So MATLAB, I would say that everything I looked at for optimization is quite stable and robust. I did not have many surprises. Julia, it's still like a moving target, at least for optimization. When I started to prepare for this lecture, I was like, I can't use Julia, like it's too new. I know Eric is pushing for it, so I made like an effort. Then Eric told me, you know, like during the previous module, people use Python. I was like, okay, maybe I should stick with MATLAB. Don't want to push people to use MATLAB. So what I did was to design the course around the modules in Julia that work well, but I'll tell you what are like what's the minefield basically out there. So don't be surprised that things are still pretty young. Even if the language Julia is pretty more stable, like toolboxes can be hit or miss. So last thing, I want to tell you a little bit about quantum information, quantum foundations, the outlook that I'm having, what I'm going to use for the lecture. Before I do that, I want to check, has everybody downloaded the stuff from GitHub, the latest repo, and is everything installed in your JupyterLab profile? Because I don't want to spend 5 minutes later on to like have those things compiled. Okay, good. I'm going to draw something and ask you if that rings a bell. Have you seen, like the, during that quantum information course, have you seen the Bell test? Like, how much do I need to tell you about that? Yes, no. Would you like to hear more about the Bell test? Trying to like get information from the room. So the idea is to look at a physical system with two subsystems and check with us making too many assumptions about the underlying physical theory or not even making a model about the what's inside the devices, be able to deduce some properties of the physical system that's shared between, let's say, the lab of Alice and the lab of Bob. We like to give things names like Alice and Bob. This makes like references easier. Basically, what's going to be there is a state, psi AB. Psi AB is a state on the Hilbert space of the first lab and tensor of the Hilbert space of the second lab, and that state can be entangled. And of course, when entanglement, like quantum theory was built, entanglement was this weird thing, and there was like a lot of resistance in the physics community. Is quantum theory the final theory because of things like the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen paradox? People were looking like, okay, maybe quantum theory is not the final theory. So in 1964, John Bell came with an argument to say, okay, there are many surprising features of quantum mechanics, but there are some that we have to accept as part of reality. And here's what we are going to do. So Bell was like, okay, what surprises you is that quantum mechanics seems to go beyond a view of physics that would use only classical information. And by that, I mean what's going in this box on the left and the right. It's some processing. So you basically, what you do, you have two physical subsystems. You're going to pick a measurement on each of the labs at random. And you're going to do that measurement on part of that quantum state, and you get a measurement outcome. And I use this weird 1-2 notation because Julia is 1-based, so we have to stick with that. And then the big question is, if we have this view of physics being classical, then the value I get here, A, can only come from S, like information I receive in this lab. And I can use information that's shared between the labs that's in the common past, in their common past light cone. But A cannot depend on T, because T, like Bob will select the measurement at the same time as Alice selects the measurement, so there is no time to propagate that information. So basically, you separate the two subsystems in a space-like fashion to prevent communication. Then you're going to ask that, okay, B can depend on T and lambda, but not on S. And that builds a model. So we are going to look at all probability distributions, P, AB given ST. Okay, and I should put like so. So we have a bad habit in quantum information is to use the same labels for the indices and the random variables. So formally what I have a random variable A, B, S, T, uppercase, which take the values A, B, S, T, lowercase. I think things will be clear from context, just interrupt me. And this comes basically from the sum over any past information that those two subsystems share, which will have a distribution that I don't know. And now A can only depend on S and lambda, and B only depends on T and lambda. And the question is, if I get a P that comes from a quantum system, do I find an explanation of that form? And Bell's theorem is actually there are quantum correlations that don't have an explanation like this. Is that familiar for you? Like, have you seen that in a lecture? Is my explanation clear? Because I haven't really prepared something to teach that. I don't have slides. So now I'm going to reformulate this problem a little bit. The thing is, if A depends only on S and lambda, it means there is a probability distribution of getting a certain value, far values of S and lambda. So that means that the value A for S equal 1 and the value A for S equal 2, I can actually compute them. Nothing prevents me from doing that. And the same for the value B for T equal 1 and B for T equal 2. What I'm doing here basically is saying that if all the information in physics is classical, I can, and I'm doing measurement on the system, I can do several measurements at the same time, like position, momentum. Before the uncertainty principle, nothing prevents me from knowing the position and the momentum at the same time. And indeed, if my observables commute, then I can get both values. The thing with quantum mechanics is that quantum mechanics is incompatible with that principle. So this is what we are going to do. We are going to compute probability distribution that come out of quantum mechanical systems. Nothing on that board is about quantum mechanics yet. But we are going to take that vector and try to see, is there an explanation of that form? And that question, is there an explanation of that form, can be phrased as a convex optimization program, which ties everything. And the cool thing is that it's only, like, what I'm going to do now is only about probability distributions, not anything quantum, not anything fancy. So if all the information in my system is classical, then it means that both values, both measurement outcomes should be available. But the trick is, because I'm only doing one measurement that I select beforehand, I only get one of those values out. So that means I can reformulate that thing here by saying, the statement here that was that P, A, B, S, T is local or Bell local if there exists a P lambda and P A given S T and P B given S lambda T lambda such that this is satisfied. Now I'm going to change a little bit the thing. If I have such a model, I can compute the values for A for S1 and A for S2. Question is, it's going to be P A B given ST is local if there exists a distribution P A1, A2, B1, B2 such that P of AB given ST it's the sum over A1, A2, B1, B2 of P, A1, A2, B1, B2. No delta function. A is the one of my measurements, and B is the one of my measurements. I'll go back to what we have here. So in that setup, when I'm basically picking measurement settings and measuring measurement outcomes, I have a probability distribution that tells me what the joint measurement outcome AB I'm going to get, conditioned on my choice of settings. Here I wrote like the local model for such a setup, but the problem of that description here, that is highly non-convex. If I were to put that in a solver, the solver would tell me, you know, like I have a polynomial of degree 3 because all these things are unknown. This is a polynomial of degree 3. And polynomial of degree 3 can have a shape like this one, which is non-convex, end of the story. So we need to reformulate the problem a little bit. So by saying that if I have such a model, then I can actually, I could do both measurements, and I can get the value of A for both measurement settings. I could get the value of B for both measurement settings. And if I have that information, then when I do my measurement, I'm basically just picking from that thing the measurement outcome that comes, that's in there, and the right measurement outcome that's in there, depending on the on my choice of SMT. I see faces kind of like, I could give you like a graphical explanation of that, if that helps, or do you just want to accept that and move on? Is that clear? Like, yes, no, maybe. Have you seen actually that stuff during the lectures?
More explanation.
You mean?
More explanation.
You'd like more explanation? Okay. So, maybe I should give you a few words about like in which circumstances those experiments are done. The idea is that wait a minute, I have my arrows going down. I have a laser here. It's going to create, it's a very attenuated laser, so it's going to create the vast majority of the time just a single photon, and with very low probability more than a single photon. So I'm going to say that here I just have one photon. 99.999% of the time, or nothing. It's one photon, most of the time. I'm setting that photon in a crystal, and there will be down conversion. That photon of high energy will be split into two photons of lower energies. And what I do is I send one photon to one lab, another photon to another lab, often using optical fibers. And usually when people do these experiments, they do that on a campus, and they use like the two buildings on the university campus that are the farther away. So then I receive that photon in a lab, and I receive the second photon in another lab. And what's going to happen is, let's say, for example, in the polarization of that photon, the state of the two photons that have been created there looks something like horizontal vertical minus vertical horizontal polarization of a square root of 2. So that's the description for my quantum mechanical system in the polarization degree of freedom in the lab A and in the lab B. And this is isomorphic to C2, tensor C2, because the polarization of a photon is a two-level system, basically. Then in those labs, I pick a measurement. So the way it's done usually is that you have a certain number of wave plates, and those wave plates will change the polarization, like rotate the polarization. Yeah?
You have one photon, or you have two photons with...
I start with one photon. Then here there is something called SPDC crystal, single photon down conversion. Yeah.
Split into two.
And it splits into two photons. And because those two photons are created like during the transformation, those photons keep I can't explain that. It's been a while. But the resulting state of the two photons in their mode of polarization is described like in superposition of they have opposite polarizations, horizontal, vertical. And if one of them is horizontal, the other one is vertical, and vice versa. And it's not a mixture. It's not like half the time they are like this or like that. It's a quantum superposition. So the state that I have here is described in this way. Then what's going to happen, I send them into labs. I use wave plates to rotate the polarization. Basically, I can choose then in which polarization basis I'm going to measure them. Then I split them. I split the polarization, and I have detectors. Same thing here. A few wave plates, change the polarization, then I use something called a polarizing beam splitter. It's a mirror that lets one polarization go through and reflects the other one, and then I can see which detector clicks. So then I'm going to assign if this detector clicks, it's going to be the measurement result A equal 1, the second one clicks A equal 2, B equal 1, B equal 2. And then I collect the statistics, like event number 1, 2, 3, 4, what values do I get for A and B, 1, 1, maybe 1, 2, 2, 1, and so on. Of course, if I just collect the statistics A and B without doing much, I just get a probability distribution, I can't say much, at least without making assumption about what's going on. So what I'm going to do is to act on one of these wave plates, like for example, rotate it at random. People have done that so that they can rotate the polarization super fast. And what I'm going to say is that I have a binary variable, binary choice of measurements, and either I rotate or I don't rotate, for example. This variable S is 1 or 2, maybe 1. I rotate, I don't. So I'm going to pick different measurement bases. And then I tabulate the event. I pick those values at random. And I repeat that for millions of events such that I can estimate the probability PAB given ST, what probability of getting the result. It's just the number, it's approximately the number of NAB ST of the sum of AB of N AB S. That's just how I estimate these frequencies. Okay, all is well, I get my data from the quantum experiments. Now the question that I'm going to ask, is the data I observe compatible with the classical model? The thing is, I always shy away from like the philosophy of quantum information or quantum mechanics because people always argue and fight and hurl insults at each other and no progress is made. So I have to be a bit careful about what I'm saying here because I take things for granted. But the idea is this. If now you want a classical description of that system, we'll give you an example. When I go to high school student and I talk about quantum stuff, I buy 2 sets of cards from the supermarket in plastic wrap like I'm doing a magic trick. People check those decks, still wrapped in the plastic, and then I open them and I turn the cards and like say it's Ace of Hearts and then King of Hearts and Queen of Hearts. It's like magic, right? Like the two decks are the same, like Occam. Okay, they come from the same factory and they put the cards in the same order. So the fact that I have correlation between those decks is not surprising. So that's the kind of same thing here. If the correlation between my result on the left and right come from the same information that was common to those two states, then it's not a surprising thing. So that's why I mean by lambda. So what I'm going to say is that maybe I observe correlation between those two measurements because at the time the photon was created, there was some information embedded in the photon that now shared between the two photons that are then converted, and that information is used in some physical model to produce my measurement outcome. So I model that variable, that information by a variable lambda, which could be, if you're a computer scientist, you're going to say it's just a big bit string. Can be whatever, it could be a real number, it could be a sequence of real numbers. That information goes into Boss Labs. Just look at what information goes in there. Which measurement do I take? And I get a measurement result. But now comes the assumption of classical physics, that now I'm going to do the Bose measurement in those labs that are separated from kilometers away. I'm going to pick the measurement setting at random. There is no way, and that's an assumption I'm making, this is the only one, there is no way that information can go there in time to produce the measurement results. Because the measurement is it's done in a very short time. And once I recorded the thing, like there was no time for, like, for example, T to come here. And classical description of the world, everything is information. So I can describe every information that's created as a probability of getting that thing, given the information that I have at that point. So A here can only depend on that prior information lambda, and S which is what I mean, that like the full description of A comes from some probability distribution that's conditioned on S and lambda. And that's my assumption. And the same thing for Bob. B comes from T and lambda. And what we're going to do is to see that the correlation of the experiments falsify a model of that type. Then it means that something weird is going on. Maybe like the information that's shared between the two boxes is actually transmitted instantaneously between the boxes. Some people work with those kind of model, like maybe a faster than light communication of information if I want to keep information to be processed in such a classical fashion. And then there are like all ways to go around and try to find explanation and so on. But what I'm focused on is like a model like this that looks reasonable can be falsified, and that Bell's theorem. So now I think the part where I went a bit fast is like, how do I go? So basically, that's not what I have in the middle board, this model of ABST. Yeah, on the top. So there should exist a P lambda, and lambda can be, I don't even know the type of lambda, so it's a very generic feasibility question here. So what I'm doing is I'm reducing that problem to the second one. And I do that in this way. If the information lambda is classical, then I can imagine the following thing. I take that measurement device, and I take two copies of it. If I can build a measurement device, I can build it twice. And if information is classical in the world, in principle, I can make copies of it. This is what I'm going to do. I'm making a copy of that information. And in that box, I'm going to measure, I'm going to do the measurement with the first setting. And in that box, I'm going to do measurement with the second setting. This is a thought experiment. If information is classical, then in principle, I can do that. And now I'm looking at, and this is the same measurement that's being done here and here in that model. And now I'm taking the outcomes for this fixed choice 1 and 2, and I'm keeping track of them. Same thing on the right-hand side. Here I go with t equal 1, here I go with t equal 2. B1 and B2. So now if I look at that model here, I have a distribution A1, A2, B1, B2, which should exist if information is classical. Now I'm going to do I'm going to recover what I have here from that. The thing is, if I have this experiment and it's running, like let's say step one of the experiment, and the lambda is going to the boxes and so on, and okay, wait. Actually, I want to measure the second measurement on the left and the first measurement on the right. What I just need to do is to take that A2 and just not care about A1, and take B1 and not just not care about B2. And that will give me exactly the outcome I would have gotten in the first model. So that's basically what I have here on the bottom. If there is a local model for my measurements, then there should exist a distribution over the outcomes of all the possible measurements I can do, such that when I select the outcome that corresponds to the one that I actually want, S, T, I get the outcome I want. So that's it. Like, that's what we are going to look at. Actually, no, it's not. I have one last thing to tell you, but this one is much easier. Am I running off of blackboards, kind of? It is just a space on this one. So what's going to happen? Front end here. It goes on top. Trick. Oh, I can actually use the background. What do you have? It's not ideal. Let's skip this one. Okay. I actually need this one on bottom, otherwise. So, if I have a qubit, let's say just for Alice, in C2, so they're just a cat, what's the constraint that I have on that cat? The only constraint I have is that this should be normalized. And the other thing is that if I have a phase, we know that things are equivalent under a global phase, because strictly speaking, we're not looking at vectors in C2, but rays, like up to a phase. We take the equivalence class of things up to that global phase. That's quantum mechanics. The only thing that we get out of that is that a two-qubit state can be written as cosinus alpha 1. So basically, I'm giving C2 the computational basis, 0, 1, and 0 and 1 are orthogonal. And now I'm expanding that qubit into its general form up to those up to this constraint and this degeneracy. So I have a phase and this part. So a qubit has basically 2 degrees of freedom. And when we are going to describe the measurement that we do in those measurement devices, they are going to be specified by 2 of these vectors, and they need to be orthogonal to each other. So we are not going to derive that, I'm just going to give the answer. If I want phi A orthogonal that has 0 overlap, a parametrization of that is minus sine alpha 1, 0, plus EI alpha 2, cos alpha 2, 1. So that's one measurement. But what we've seen here is that we have 2 of such boxes. So the probability of getting something it's given by bound rule, and it's basically the measurement that I'm going to do on Alice's side, maybe with a perpendicular or not, depending on which outcome. Yeah?
I think you should have the same argument in sine and cos.
You mean the?
Same argument in the sine and the cos function.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Sorry. Yeah, good catch. So basically, what's going to be my probability of getting some measurement outcome? So of course, what I have those vectors for the first qubit, but I have the same thing, it's like, let's say, phi b, that depends on beta 1 and beta 2. And now I compute the probability of getting projection on those things. It's the overlap times its complex conjugate, so the absolute value squared. So that's going to be my probability. And the state that I'm going to measure things on is the singlet state. I had written it somewhere on the blackboard. I will just repeat it. It's 0, 1 minus 1, 0 over square root of 2. So all these things are in the notebooks. Now I'm done with like the theory part. We won't go harder than this. Like this was like the only the parts of quantum info that I'm going to use. Maybe what should we do? Maybe we should take a small break or something. Oh no, actually we go until 3 p.m. It's time to switch to computers. No, the question is, the screen is going to go down. I think the way out of that, I advise that you take note of what we have on the board, because as you see, the screen is going to block half of it. The thing is, in the Jupyter notebooks, you have this information, like the equation that I have on those boards, they are there, but maybe there are a bit more details on the blackboard. So what I advise, I will leave like that stuff up for, let's say, a few minutes, and we can all go together to now exercise 1A, nonlinear unconstrained optimization. And basically, everything that's on the board is there in the explanation. And what I want you to look at is the function singlet proj prob. And have a look at how it's designed. And I'll comment to that on that in a minute. Is everybody okay that now I get the screen down? There we go. So, the first thing I wanted to give you is a non-constrained.
Size is a bit small. Increase.
Yes, that's a good point. Thank you. Can I just like the zoom thing? Is it? Yeah, I think it works. There is no zoom level in Jupyter itself, right? You just zoom the browser. Or should I do this? Okay, that works. Is that good at that size?
Yes.
Excellent. Excellent. So here are the things. So we are going to do measurement on the singlet state, like the one that I had written on the board. We are going to parameterize the local measurement. That's exactly the expression that we had before. And now we have two measurement settings for the first on the first Hilbert space. And each measurement is given by two projectors, so two states that have overlap zero, and state of overlap zero, they have that parameterization with only two angles, that's sufficient. But because we have two measurement settings, we have two of such states. So the number of degrees of freedom in that family of measurement for Alice is four. Two angles for the first measurement, two angles for the second measurement setting. Now for the second lab, Bob, again, we have two measurement settings that are given by the family of those things. Measurement are one base, indices are one base because MATLAB and Julia, and we are going to compute that probability distribution, PAB given ST. Below, there is an objective that we are going to optimize later. I'm going to skip that part, like the CHS8 expression, I'm skipping it for now. What we are going to look at is this function. There are a few things that I need to tell you. At PI, we like the hockey sticks. So basically, what did I do? The vector, like this array A, it's basically Hilbert space computational basis. The indices 1 and 2 correspond to the first and second element of the ket. Then what I have here is the value of A equal 1 or 2. So these two things are orthogonal, and that's S. So it's A, Hilbert space dimension, A, S, and the same for B, Hilbert space, B, and T. And the thing that I've done here for simplicity is I remove the complex part, like this exponential imaginary times angle. I'm just keeping things real for 4 minutes. Then what I'm going to do is to compute an array of P, A, B given ST, which is what I have here. How do I do that? For all possible measurement settings, for all possible outcomes, I take the Kronecker product of the cats, but now I need a bra because I'm going to compute the overlap. So this is why I have the adjoint over here. And here I have the singlet state. Because of the tensor product, I'm basically enumerating things like 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1, which is why that vector has that shape and the normalization factor. But now the probability is basically the modulus squared of that complex amplitude. So I just take like the conjugate times the value, and sometimes it's nice to like force things to be real if I have like a floating point error in the imaginary component, and I return that array. There are probably things that you find a bit weird in my declaration up there. We're going to see in a minute why I'm using that. Other question about like that a piece of code?
So what is the type?
Oh, okay. Yeah, it's coming later. Like, if there are no other questions, I'm happy to answer this one. So the thing is, I don't know if you use that in the other modules. Eric, you can like tell me like the genericity in types. Have we used it before in the lecture, in this course?
Parametric types?
Yeah.
I emphasized them in the beginning.
Yeah.
In the applications, it was not emphasized.
Okay. So the trick is, we could totally say that those things are float 64 and complex F64 to say it's all floating point numbers. But what's going to happen later on, we will work with algorithms that want the gradient of the function. And Julia is amazing because if you write your code in a generic way, it will just put numbers that keep track of the derivatives in that function and it will work naturally. If you want, you can remove them and it will crash later. Just saying, I want a multidimensional array filled with zeros, but those zeros should have the same type as the inputs. So if you use float with 32 bits of precision, everything will be 32 bits of precision. If you want increased precision, say 128 bits, you just put the argument with that increased precision, everything is going to follow. So this is very generic. So that's my function. What I'd like us to do is run that first cell here. May compile stuff if it's the first time you're running it. Run that function here. We're just going to skip the CHSH. We'll go there when it's using optim. And what I just want us to do is to do singlet proj prob of x0 and see what comes out of that. We should get some probabilities for those random angles that we have here. If everybody sees a vector, like a multidimensional array, that looks a bit like that, that means it's working. So basically, I skipped the CHSH stuff. I'm coming to that in a minute. I'm just taking random angles here. Now they are float 64, so that's what we're going to use. Four of them, and they can be 0 to 2 pi. And I'm computing that probability distribution. So now we can move to the optimization part. It was a long prelude to go to that part and start to work on stuff. I'll tell you a few words about the CHSH expression. When Bell derived his theorem, it was not something you could really test in an experiment. It had additional constraints that were not very experimentally friendly. The CHSH experimental proposal was 74, so around like 6 years later. The author of that paper realized that if you take that linear combination of the probability distribution coefficients, so there's kind of it's basically a sum of those coefficients with plus and, or minus one prefactors. And the prefactors, they basically depend on A, B, S, and T. If you have something that's a local model, that value should not exceed 2. So now what we are going to do is to optimize over the measurement setting that we can use, compute that expression, and see if we can go with quantum mechanics higher than 2. If we can go higher than 2, we basically disprove, falsify a classical explanation for those correlations. So how is it implemented in that code? Like it's a stupid for loop. I'm computing that expression over there. I'm always trying to keep the Julia code very plain and simple, even if that means nested for loops. We have it there, and now we are going to do an optimization here. First of all, I'm going to use the optim package. It's a package that works with black box functions. Like you define them, give the function to the solver. No need to like find a canonical form for anything. It's very, very plain. Because it's nonlinear optimization, we always have a starting point, and it's best to use to have that point random and run it a few times. And basically, what I've done is to give you all the ceremonial you need to have to run different Julia packages. So here is an algorithm that doesn't need the gradients. You cannot just run it, and you're going to see all that algorithm finds a maximum. And this maximum is 2.8, which is higher than the value 2 that would be the limit for classical physics. So I'm going to leave you run that. And then there are a few other algorithms in that notebook that you can try and see what you recover. Is it running on every computer? Cool. So the thing is, we have a few algorithms here. The first one is called Nelder-Mead. What it's doing, that method, Wikipedia has a very nice picture. It's keeping, like in a 2D space, it would use 3 points. In an n-dimensional space, it uses n plus 1 points, and it keeps a simplex. And then what it's going to do is to move that simplex, always keeping the two, like the n legs that have the most optimal values, and move the point that has the worst value. And there are like a few rules, how it's moving. Like most of the time, it's just going to do a reflection step. It's moved that point to the other side and reduce a bit the volume of that simplex. And it's designed so that it doesn't need the gradient information, just evaluate the function at a few points, and then discard the point that has the worst objective value, and then pick a new point in some sort of optimal fashion and move stuff. It's a very dumb algorithm. It doesn't use any higher order derivative, does not try to build the model of the function using a Taylor expansion, which means it's very robust if your objective function is not differentiable everywhere. The downside of that algorithm is that it often needs a lot of function evaluations. The second algorithm, it's also derivative free. It's Bobby Qua, and that one is pretty cool. What's happening in this notebook, we are moving between optim, which contains a few optimization algorithms, and nlopt, which contain other optimization algorithms, and I've written every time the ceremonial to run the optimization. What Bobby Qua is doing is sampling your function at first around a few points until it has enough samples to build a quadratic model, so like the Taylor expansion at second order. And then it's going to pick new points trying to achieve two goals. The first goal is to go to the optimum that you're looking for. But often if you just try to optimize for that while you're moving along, the problem is that your sample space will become degenerate. So at the same time, the algorithm trying to maintain the sampling quality by sometimes taking steps that are not that optimal, but just keep a good quality of the model. It works extremely well. A good feature of that algorithm is that when it goes near the objective, it's going to oversample. So even if you have an objective that's noisy, you could actually get an objective value that the algorithm returns that has like an order of magnitude less noise than what your function evaluation returns. So it's a great default one. And as you can see, it's like twice as fast as the Neldom-made algorithm. But as the number of variables increase, that difference will be more and more striking. If you have, for example, you optimize over some kind of simulation and it's kind of a black box, Bobiqua will be extremely robust to work with, like, for every evaluation of the function, I need to run a simulation. That works extremely well. How do those two algorithms work? Basically, you pass them the handle of the function that you're optimizing over, the initial point, and then which solver do you want to use, some options. You can have a look at the help for the package for that. Envelope has a different function calling convention. Supposedly, your objective functions should return the gradient, but because we use Bobiqua that doesn't use gradients, we basically just don't care about that parameter. But if you don't put it, then Julia will not be happy. Is it actually? Yeah, it's happy. But this time it works. Anyway, just putting it to be sure. Now we move to, for the next two or three, we move to optimization algorithms that don't sample to build the model. Like the first one, the first method, the Newton method, basically takes for every function evaluation the function value at the point, the gradient, and the second order derivatives. So that gives exactly the Taylor expansion of the function around that point, and then minimizes that. But for that, you need actually to compute the gradient and the Hessian. What's really cool with Julia is that because we wrote our function in a generic way, we just need to give that option autodiff forward, and it will call our function in a way that's like propagating derivatives along the way, and that will be quite fast and work pretty well. So in 5 iterations, it converges. But it may be that actually computing that Hessian takes a lot of memory and so on. So it doesn't mean that it's going to be more efficient than other methods. Now, most of the time, people remark you don't need to have the exact Hessian to actually converge quite quickly. So the next two algorithms, they only use gradients, and they build an approximation of the Hessian along the way with some update rule. They worked extremely well. So these are like the two I recommend. For us, it doesn't make any difference. It's just that Julia is going to do less work for these two to compute the actual Hessian using that auto-differentiation. So those work extremely well too. You know, even if we spend like 8 iterations on this one compared to the 5 iterations, it may well be that in like real life, those will be faster because they don't need to propagate that big matrix. So that's basically the story. I have like a few exercises that I don't think we have much time to do today because things are ending like in 3 minutes. So we look at them like the next at the next session. One thing that I'd like that corresponds to what you're going to do if you do optimization for a paper, often you just don't want to publish. Like, okay, let's have a look. You don't want to publish this, basically. Like, give angles that are just floating point values. If you can find a nice algebraic expression for those, that would be better. So one thing that I like to do, and that we're going to have a look at, is maybe actually, like, what we're going to see is that there is not only a single minimizer, like, or maximizer. Maybe things are actually here, I think, in that model, that way may be. This looks suspiciously close to 2 pi, so maybe we could replace that one with 0. And you like make hypothesis, and you see if you can keep the objective being optimal and try to round up these numbers to something algebraic. That's what we're going to try to find actually these angles. In the parameterization, we did not use complex qubits. So I want you to modify the code to now go to 8 parameters, doubling the number of angles. And the last thing is, we use the singlet state, but we could use more, a more general family of states. Can we do better by using something more? And then there are like open and death exercises that we are not going to look, but if you're curious, that's something you could have a look at. That concludes that first part. I'm happy to take questions, but if I see people move here, that maybe we have people coming up, so we'll wrap stuff up in minutes. Other questions? Not so much. So yeah, next time there will be more, I had planned like more exercises and more computer stuff. I spent a lot of time today on quantum information stuff. Next lecture will be a bit different. There will be more practical things to do. Thank you for your attention and see you on Wednesday.